They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Voters go to the polls.
And Fed officials go to the boardroom.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hello from American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, November 2nd, Election Day.
Coming up, France and the UK join forces, armed forces, to save a little money. Plus, as California votes on whether to decriminalize marijuana, we meet a woman who's already in the business.
But first, the Fed meets and voters vote. For more, we're joined by Julie Neiman, an analyst at Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, first off, we've got these two big stories today, obviously the midterm elections, but also the Fed starts its two-day meeting today that many are expecting is going to end with some kind of announcement about injecting more money into the economy. Julie, which of those stories are you and your investor friends paying more attention to?
Well, the election's pretty well baked into the market. We're expecting the Democrats to win the Senate, the Republicans the House, which means there's going to be no further government stimulus. And that did account for about 1.5% of growth here in the United States. So we've got a stalled game for the next 2 years as we breathlessly await the 2012 elections.
Okay, well, assuming all those predictions are correct and Republicans do make big gains in the House, how does that change the Fed's role in getting the economy going again?
Well, the ball's completely in the Federal Reserve's court, but the problem is it's a deflated ball. QE2 starts tomorrow, in all likelihood they're going to be
quantitative easing, too.
Quantitative easing, right. Buying about $500 billion worth of government bonds. This will pour more money into the banks. Interest rates are going to stay near zero, and lending stays very anemic to businesses. Banks have little incentive to lend, so it's not going to have any other effect other than to put the financial institutions awash in cash.
Well, we'll still be watching what happens tonight. Julie Neiman, analyst with Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis, thanks so much.
You bet.
Within the next day or two, General Motors will likely finalize plans for an initial public offering. The Detroit automaker's IPO could raise billions of dollars and allow GM to partially repay taxpayers for the bailout it got from Uncle Sam. Mickey Maynard is senior editor of the Midwest Public Radio Project, Changing Gears. He's with us from Chicago. Good morning.
Hello, Steve.
Explain this to me. GM going public. Does this mean that taxpayers no longer own the automaker?
Oh, not at all. The taxpayers own about 61% of General Motors. And once this stock sale takes place, it's expected that that stake will go down to about 40%. So we'll own less than half of General Motors, but we'll still own a big chunk.
We'll be sitting in the back seat instead of the front seat, right?
I guess that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. There we go. Did we get a good deal, the taxpayer get a good deal out of the GM purchase?
You know, it's impossible to say yet whether financially we got a good deal, because there are people who say the money will never be completely paid back. But what we got out of this was the economy didn't crater. People said that, you know, letting the car makers go out of business might really crater the economy. That didn't happen. Jobs were preserved. Dealerships stayed open. Some of them closed. So we'll see. We'll know in a few years whether this was a good deal or not.
All right. Mickey Maynard, senior editor of the Midwest Public Radio Project, Changing Gears. Mickey, thanks.
My pleasure.
So if the federal government is selling shares in GM, who's buying? Well, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, a lot of the investors will likely be overseas.
Investment bankers are said to be shopping the IPO to investors in places like Kuwait, Qatar, and Singapore. And there's talk of investment from China. State-owned Shanghai Automotive is a longtime GM partner there. Here's analyst Bill Russo at Synergistics.
They bring low-cost production capacity.
and they bring a fair understanding and knowledge of what it takes to compete in some of these emerging markets.
If the Chinese buy a small piece of GM, expect political heat. But Russo's analysis? Chill out. GM is already becoming Global Motors.
GM is transitioning from a North American-centered company to a more global company with a new center emerging in its largest overall market, which is China.
Its China partnership has turned Buick into a top seller there. And the joint venture's next venture is India. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The U.S. Supreme Court hears a case today that could have a big effect on violent video games. Now, video game developers cite the First Amendment when states such as California want to fine or punish retailers who sell those gruesome games to kids. From Silicon Valley, Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Steve Paputis runs a team at Entertainment Arts building a new game called Dead Space 2.
Our protagonist, Isaac Clarke, fights to destroy a government plot to resurrect an evil artifact known as the Marker.
Clarke battles a giant mechanical robot zombie scorpion and hordes of ghouls. It sounds ridiculous, but the trailer gave me chills. The $10 billion gaming industry has voluntary ratings that are designed to keep games like this away from kids, but
there's no teeth behind the rating system.
That's California State Senator Leland Yee. He authored a bill that would fine retailers $1,000 for selling ultraviolent video games to kids. The industry challenged that law, and it was overturned. But today, the Supreme Court hears California's appeal, and that has Steve Paputis worried.
I just want to make sure that our form of media is treated the same way as film and books.
If the law is upheld, designers will still be free to make any game they like, but retailers will have to be very careful about who they sell those games to. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, November 2nd. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers section at our website, marketplace.org.
We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects the United States.
Just 3 months after sealing the worst offshore oil leak in U.S. history, the British oil giant BP is back in profitable territory, $1.85 billion in the past 3 months, just to be exact. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London with that. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
Well, this is quite a turnaround. Just after the Gulf spill, a lot of folks were talking bankruptcy.
It is remarkable. If you think that in the previous 3 months, the company suffered the biggest quarterly loss in UK history, $17 billion. So far, the Gulf of Mexico disaster has cost, or the bill for BP is $40 billion. That's the total sum the company has set aside to pay for capping the well, cleaning up the spill and compensating for the damage. In spite of these enormous sums, the company is now making a profit.
So
again,
where are these profits even? Where are they coming from?
Oil.
I mean, okay.
If this company had been involved in virtually any other business and suffered this kind of financial and reputational hit, it really would be struggling. But the demand for oil is such that BP's been making very good revenues. Asfar Shakat is an oil analyst with consulting firm Mott MacDonald, and he says, apart from the disaster in the Gulf, other bits of BP have been thriving.
The refining and marketing business has done very, very well. And in fact, in the U.S., the refining operation made a profit for the first time this year.
One caveat, BP has, as we've heard, set aside $40 billion to cover the cost of the spill. But as all the lawsuits begin to bite, it is possible that figure could rise.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
While we're on the subject of BP, today's earnings could be a first clue that the oil giant's bad PR over the last 6 months won't be a hindrance to its bottom line in the long term. Marketplace's Eve Tro has that part of the story.
BP is likely to be a bad guy in the court of public opinion for, well, decades. Past disasters prove that, says energy analyst Phil Weiss.
When you hear the term Valdez, you think of Exxon, even though that was 20 years ago.
The Valdez spill proves another point. The year Exxon coated the Alaska coast with oil, it still saw $3.8 billion in profits. Weiss says BP's bottom line won't take a long-term hit from the Gulf spill either.
While reputation can sometimes depress a stock price, it doesn't really have anything to do with how the business is running.
Which, he says, is still strong. You'd think environmentalists would resent that, but LG Holstein with the Environmental Defense Fund says it's good news the company is healthy.
Those who have claims for damages against BP, including the federal government, will be in a strong position to collect on those fines and penalties.
Even if it takes 20 years, like it did for the Exxon Valdez. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
From the Marketplace, we never thought this would happen file. Today, Britain and France are going to sign a landmark military agreement. You heard right. Despite the fact that for centuries, the two have been pretty hardcore enemies. The BBC's Rebecca Singer reports.
The French and British famously waged a 100-year war against one another. But now the enemy of government deficits has led the two countries to sign a treaty to share their military costs. The proposals include creating a rapid reaction force made up of troops from both countries under one command, as well as ideas to share aircraft carriers. Liam Fox is the UK's defence secretary. He says the agreement will take advantage of economies of scale.
Remember that Britain and France together are responsible for about 50% of all the defence spending within the EU countries. It makes a lot of sense for us not to spend money reinventing the wheel, but to work together where we can.
While there is already some close cooperation between Britain and France, there have also been big differences in opinion, most recently over involvement in the Iraq War. And any deal would allow each country to decide which fights it wanted to stay out of. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
From the global perspective to the galactic perspective, if all goes as planned weather-wise, the Space Shuttle Discovery will launch for the final time tomorrow. It's one of the three remaining shuttles, which are all facing retirement. NASA is transitioning more of its $19 billion annual budget toward other spacecraft that can travel deeper into space. Paul Barrett has written about the economic consequences of all of this for the latest edition of Bloomberg Businessweek, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Well, first, I want to start with a line in your story. 8,000 engineers, technicians, and other employees are going to lose their jobs because of the retirement of the space shuttle. What is this doing to Florida?
Well, what it's doing is making a really terrible economic situation much worse, particularly in the small towns around the Kennedy Space Center on the east coast of Florida.
But as you report, the impact goes far beyond the borders of the state of Florida. This really has to do with American competitiveness.
It does. While the American space program is adrift, the programs in countries such as Russia, China, India are really cruising ahead, and the United States stands to lose a significant portion of the market in the global space industry.
Where does the problem lie?
Well, the problem lies in several places, but one place to start is in the fact that the federal government has come to treat the NASA space program as more of a federal jobs program, spreading resources out across a large number of NASA centers around the country and worrying more about preserving jobs as they exist rather than looking out into the future and figuring out how to best deploy resources. So politics is one big part of the problem.
Paul Barrett, after doing this reporting, do you think that the U.S. will be able to remain the world's leader in space?
I think that is now very much open to question with rising China, rising India. There's a real serious question whether the United States will remain on the cutting edge in this hugely expensive undertaking that requires centralized and collective action. This is not something that can be done by rugged individuals. Basically, the whole country has to pull together and agree to do this and to spend a lot of money.
Paul Barrett, who's got a big story on NASA in the latest Bloomberg Business Week. Thanks so much for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, November 2nd. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org. On this election day, Californians vote on whether to allow people to keep small amounts of marijuana for personal use. If it passes, new business opportunities, of course, could open up, like what's already happened for medical marijuana, which is legal in the state. Marketplace's Rico Galliano, co-host of our sister show, The Dinner Party Download, spoke with a Los Angeles woman who's carved out a unique place in the medical marijuana business.
My name is Melanie, and I bake edibles for medical marijuana dispensaries, and my company is called Red Eye Bakery.
And how did you decide to start doing this?
I was working at a dispensary, and one of the guys that I worked with was doing it, but he was only like 20 years old and wanted to have a life. And so it was like, hey, Melanie, do you want to do it? He only made muffins, and I started making cookies and crispy treats and like pretty much anything. You know, I've made like little cheesecakes before and stuff like that as well.
All with marijuana in it, and this is a completely above ground business.
It definitely is. And not only here in California, there's other states. I think it's like 15 total now that have medical marijuana. I definitely have spread the word to some of my friends in Oregon and some of my friends in Colorado that they should look into doing it because it's a good way to build your own business because not a lot of people do it.
So there's like a weed baker entrepreneurial vacuum?
And there's a need for it, especially people who make good ones. For anybody who's ever tried them, sometimes it's hard to find ones that taste good because people are, you know, not using the best quality buds or, you know, they're not making it correctly.
Well, this is going to be my next question. Do you have a background in cooking?
You know, I've just always loved to cook and being a mom, I guess. But I've been cooking since I was like 8 years old. My mom was a really bad cook and I didn't like bad food. So immediately I had to decide I was going to cook on my own.
Is she aware of what you're doing?
Yeah, my mom knows, and my whole family knows. My mom actually has multiple sclerosis and eats my brownies from time to time. And actually, for a little while, my brother and my sister-in-law were struggling, and she started coming over and baking for me. So it's also helped my brother pay his bills, too.
How many times, by the way, speaking of baking, how many times a day do people make that pun?
All the time, actually. And what's something that's funny is if I ever try and bake stuff that has no marijuana in it, everybody asks me first, is this medicated? I'm like, no, of course it's not medicated. Why would I bring medicated cupcakes to a party?
There are some parties where that would be welcome.
Yes, but you know, 4th of July with the family, I usually don't bring medicated cupcakes.
That's Marketplace's Rico Galliano speaking with Melanie at Red Eye Bakery in Los Angeles. Check out dinnerpartydownload.org for more.
And finally, forget installing that expensive home security system or that sign that says you have a pit bull, even if you really don't.
Oh.
No, Steve, the researchers at the U.S. Forest Service say the cheaper option to deter crime is to plant trees.
Oh, very nice.
A maple, a weeping willow, whatever it is.
Environmentally safe, too, and friendly.
Friendly. It gives you some shade in the summertime. The researchers say that trees make would-be burglars think that the neighborhood is better cared for, so they think they'd be more likely to get caught.
So it's cleaner, neater.
Nicer neighborhood.
Nicer neighborhood.
However, they did say that small trees actually increase the amount of crime because they don't give you the sense that the neighborhood is better cared for, and also they hide you as you try to sneak through the window.
What happens if you live in the desert? Ooh.
I don't know. I not a lot of crime there, maybe.
It's too hot.
You can send us your tweets, by the way, of your favorite crime-preventing trees. I'm at Jeremy Hobson on Twitter, and Steve, you are?
Chio, M-M-R, C-H-I-O-M-M-R.
I'm sorry if I just gave you a whole bunch of trees that you didn't want to see, but
maple,
now you will.
Oak, weeping willow. I like the weeping willow.
Weeping willow. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.